Okay, this is Mark Joyner, and I am really blessed and privileged to be here today with a wonderful guest by the name of Gary Halbert. And Gary today has promised very, very generously to tell a story, a fantastic story about one of the greatest marketing successes in history. And Gary is not only going to tell this story today, but he is going to break down for you exactly why this particular campaign and all of its various iterations were so outrageously successful. Let me give you a little background about Gary Halbert. Gary Halbert has been in the direct marketing world for well over 50 years. Gary, is that correct? About 40 years?
About 40 years, yeah.
40 years. I started in the internet business less than 10 years ago, and you know, some people consider me an expert in what I do in a very short period of time. Gary has got more than four times that level of experience in his direct marketing world, and I have to tell you, direct marketing is 20 times harder than internet marketing. It is a much more difficult field. So for that, I have tremendous respect for Gary, not just because he has experience, but because on top of that experience, he has some of the greatest direct marketing successes in the history of the world. And this particular story is one of them. I just want to give you a little brief idea of what we're about to talk about here before I let Gary tell the story, because he will certainly tell it far more eloquently and accurately than I will. What we're talking about here is a letter known as the Coat of Arms Letter. This letter was sent out over 600 million times. 600 million people have received this letter. You know, maybe some duplicates there, but any letter that's sent out that many times tells you something. Marketing that is not good does not repeat itself, okay, simply because the economics do not work. You simply cannot afford to send out bad marketing over and over and over again. If a letter has been sent out 600 million times, that in itself is an incredible piece of proof that this is an incredible letter. Now, this may be one of the most distributed letters in the history of the world. This, in the first year, I believe, and Gary will give accurate stats on this, I may have some of this wrong, but generated millions of customers, okay, and eventually Gary sold out to another company that picked this up and later sold this business to Ancestry.com for $70 million. That was just the sale of this business. We're not even talking about all the profits involved in this. Anyway, with that said, I want to turn it over to Gary and let him tell that story. So, Gary, welcome, and thank you very much for appearing today.
All right. Well, you're welcome, Mark, and you said some very nice things about me. That was a good introduction. I think the facts that you gave are just slightly skewed because I didn't explain to them correctly, but not in any serious way, and I'll straighten it out if
sure.
I tell a story.
Please.
About this. But first, I'm going to give your listeners a little bit of background. When I got interested in direct marketing, I became truly obsessed with it. I wrote copy during the day. I studied it at night and in the evening, and I dreamt about it at night. And I read every book I could get my hands on. Mm. And I didn't have very much money, but the money that I did have, if a book didn't exist in my hometown library or I couldn't get it in the bookstore, I'd travel to the Library of Congress to get it. I would travel to the Manhattan Library to get it. And I want to make a point, is almost every great marketer I know, if you want to know if he's a good marketer, walk in and look at his bookshelf, you know.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I studied all these marketing books, and I kept mailing direct mail campaign after direct mail campaign, and none of them worked.
Yeah.
I was married, I had children, and I would sometimes be sitting in a house without running water or electricity because I had spent the money to make mailings, anticipating orders that never materialized. So one day, I was sitting down in my little study that I had in my basement in Massillon, Ohio, and I got to thinking, you know, what would I do if I didn't have all these experts to guide me? what would I do to make, if I had to make this work, or I would be headed, or my children would be killed or something. So I started thinking about direct mail. And this is the gun, what I call gun to the head thinking. And what you're about to listen to is the genesis of something that has made hundreds of millions of dollars. And a lot of this applies in more ways than you would ever guess to the Internet. In fact, it's even more important to the Internet once you understand it.
Mm.
First thing, if I wrote a direct mail letter and I had to get a response or something cataclysmic would happen, the first thing I would do is I would want to make sure that that letter got delivered. And so, therefore, I would put a first-class stamp on it. Everybody back then was mailing bulk freight, and most people do now because it's so much cheaper. Well, the reason, and my early reasoning is why I would use a first-class stamp, is, first of all, at any given time, you make a mailing, a certain percentage of the people have moved. And if you mail bulk rate, that mail does not get forwarded.
Yes.
If you mail first class, it does get forwarded. Okay. The next thing I reasoned was that I wouldn't put anything that on the envelope that gave away the fact that envelope held a commercial message.
Yes.
In other words, I would not use a label. I wouldn't use any teaser copy. I just put a name and address. And at that time, I was married to a woman named Nancy. And it was just Nancy L. Halbert, and we put our address there. And then I decided I would either handwrite or type the address. Now, you know, this is going to be a thumbnail version of a mini lecture a lot of people have heard. And that is my semi-famous A pile, B pile lecture. In that, and I maintain that everybody sorts their mail while they're standing over a wastebasket.
Yep.
Now, everything they throw away, almost all of their what I call B pile mail, and that's everything that's obviously advertising. And Andy Rooney did a piece on that just 2 weeks ago about how he sorts through his mail.
Mm.
Throws away anything that has a label. Throws away anything that has teaser copy.
Yes.
You know, throws away anything that has bulk rate on it, et cetera.
Right.
So the first object I figured is I would make my mail look like I was mailing a letter to my friend Mark Joyner.
You know,
and I'd put my name in the corner card, you know, and I'd put Mark Joyner and your address and the other card, and I'd put a first class mail on it and send it to you. I didn't know it at the time, but that was a very good thing to do for another reason.
Yeah.
And the other reason was that the post office throws away an awful lot of mail that they consider commercial mail.
Mm.
There are horror stories by the hundreds in newspapers throughout the years of people dumping millions of dollars of what they call junk mail or commercial mail.
Right.
And my guess is that they fail to deliver 17% of it on the average, but on some gloomy days, they just chuck it all because they figure nobody will miss it. You know?
Right, right.
So the first thing I wanted to do is to get my mail delivered by the post office. And the second thing is I wanted to get it delivered to the recipient, because if the recipient moved, I wanted it to be forwarded.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the next part of it is when he opened the mail, all I wanted him to see was a letter, and it would appear to be a typed letter, and there wouldn't be any yes or no tokens, nothing on there, nothing but a pure letter. This particular letter that we're going to be discussing today was one page, 361 pages, 361 words. That's all it was.
Mm.
Okay. Now, with that as kind of a preface, I'm going to tell you some things that most of your listeners don't know.
Great.
They don't know that once upon a time, people did not have personal computers. That's probably too long ago for them to remember.
That's right.
And when people didn't have personal computers, and even they didn't even have word processors, everybody with large mailing lists, and there were many large mailers, they kept them all in what they called alphabetical order, you know. And that's how they keep their files, and that's how they would address their names and so forth. And the they had a choice. Let's say they were going to mail 100,000 letters. You know, there's a couple of ways they could do it. One is personalized, and one is not personalized.
Right.
And not personalized would say, "Dear sir, dear madam, dear friend, dear resident, dear occupant, dear fellow golfer," or something like that.
Yeah.
The other choice was to do it personalized. Personalized would entail that you'd actually have to handwrite every letter, or you'd actually have to type every letter, or they had robot typewriters, so that one woman would type the name and an address of Mark Joyner, for example, and 20 robots would then pick it up. She'd type Mark Joyner, Gary Halbert, Bob Smith, you know, Lou Brown, whatever the name was, and then the robots would take it up from there.
Right.
Now there's very, very, very few people personalized mail. I would guess that of all the mail that went out back then, that maybe 0.001% of mail was personalized if it was commercial mail.
It's hard to get an ROI on that, right?
Huh?
It was hard to get an ROI on
that. Oh, unless you were selling a battleship, it was almost
impossible. Right, right.
And so nobody did that. So, however, when it was done, you would get, as a rule of thumb, three times the gross response that you would get by simply mailing a dear friend or a dear occupant letter.
Yep.
Now, of course, it would cost you an arm and a leg to do that. You couldn't make a buck doing that.
Yeah.
Along came computers. And a lot of people don't know that the early computers, they printed things out on big sheets that you could cut, and sometimes you could make letters out of them, but they only printed in capital letters.
Right.
So if you got a letter that was computer generated, what it looked like was a declaration of war.
Right.
Okay. And then IBM started a revolution in its infancy when they came out with the first upper and lower case print chain. Now, I don't know exactly what a print chain is, but I think I sort of know. But the main thing is that you could send computer letters and it would be a capital M, small A-R-K, capital J-O-Y-N-E-R.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So now you could make your letters looked like they had been typed on a personal typewriter. Now, the thing about this is that this technology was in its infancy, and there were two really, really drawbacks, even though they made this possible. By the way, I think the first upper and lower print chain was owned by a friend of mine named Leo Yoakum. I've lost track of him. But he owned Printronics in New York City.
Yep.
Anyway, the thing is, if you wanted to send personal letters, it was still so expensive.
Right.
You probably couldn't make a buck on it. And even if it could, you had to hire a geek to do it for you.
Right.
And in those days, geeks were really, really rare.
That's right.
I mean, you couldn't find them. And secondly, things would really screw up all of the time.
Right.
And thirdly, once your geek would get this done, have your files computerized, he'd just own you. He could tell you he wanted triple, what you were paying him before.
That's right, because he had control of everything.
Yes, because he just walked away. It's like giving one of the tellers to the bank who makes minimum wage almost, she's the only person with the combination to the safe.
Right.
That's what the tech was back then. So all of this was really very, very unsatisfactory.
Yep.
And I happened to be reading some cheap opportunity-type newspaper, and it had little deals about how you could make extra money. And one of them was about a little old lady who was supplementing her income, and what she would do is she'd go to her county library, and she would look up, say, the name Joyner and
right.
see if it was recorded with a coat of arms.
Yep.
And if it was, she'd make us an ink sketch of the Joyner coat of arms.
Right.
Then she'd get the telephone books for all the city in her county. And she'd look up all the Joiners and handwrite a postcard for all the Joiners in that particular county. And she would send it out and say, "Mr. Joyner, I'm whoever I am, and my hobby is doing heraldic research, and I have found out that your name, Joyner, was recorded with a coat of arms
right.
700 years ago, and I'm on this postcard. I'm recreating a black and white sketch of it. You should see what it looks like in full color. And I hope you're interested enough to see what it looks like in full color. Because the way I supplement my income is I paint, once I discover a coat of arms that people are interested in, I paint them on walnut plaques in gorgeous full color."
Right.
And right there, it just hit me like it was one of the biggest epiphanies of my life. What she did.
Yeah.
And she, and so then I discovered, my God, all I can send now letters, I can take what she's doing on a larger scale and say, I can get telephone books from all over the United States.
Yeah.
And I can look up every Joiner in all of these cities. And hand address them to them, and then better than that, I can type one letter, "Dear Mr. Joyner," and mention your name a few times throughout the letter, and take it to an offset printer and have it printed up.
Now, Gary, can I interject something here really quick? That part of your story that you just told to me was the most profound and impressive part, and I'm sure there's a lot more here. I mean, I've learned probably 100 things just from these last 10 minutes.
That's actually the most impressive part.
I would say, I got to tell you, there are strokes of genius that have made people millionaires in the past, and just to give you an example to compare this, Bill Gates had a stroke of genius when he had a single negotiation with IBM. And IBM didn't think money was in software, and Bill Gates asked for the rights to be able to continue to sell upgrades to the DOS operating system. That single negotiation point is what launched the company that made him the richest man in the world. And I just got to say, that little point right there, I wanted to tune into that, because what you did there was on that caliber. That fact is what made this thing such an incredible success, I believe.
Well, that is the central fact, and I'm going to tell you how I exploited it. But
awesome.
I have a saying that might be worth remembering.
Yes.
And that is, properly exploited, one good idea that occurs to you while walking on the beach is worth more than 10 lifetimes of hard work.
That's right. Damn right.
Okay. Anyway, so I did this, but I didn't know what to mail to all of these Joiners that I was going to mail to, but now I could do it an awful lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And people had told me anyway that nobody in history had ever made a direct mail promotion work to a telephone book list because the list was too general.
Right.
And back at that time, I had a big ego, probably bigger ego needs would be better described it. And I decided I wanted to make the telephone book work. And to make a list work, you've got, the list has to have something in common. Well, telephone names do have something in common.
Yeah.
They all have a name, and they all
beautiful.
Have an address.
Beautiful.
Okay?
Yep.
And so back then, it was the dawn of the age of the digitized society. And I don't mean that digitized as in computer, but people felt they were losing their identity even back then. You know, you're just a number.
That's right.
And I thought people would really like maybe be interested in something personal. And I thought back to that little old lady again, and I thought maybe they would be interested in knowing if their name was ever recorded with a family crest.
Beautiful.
And so I wrote a test letter to find out. And I found out that if I mailed to all of the joiners, and the letter was, "Dear Mr. Joiner, do you know that your family name was recorded with a family crest in ancient heraldic archives more than 700 years ago?" And then it went on from there.
Oh, it's so subtle. It's beautiful.
However, it took about 18 months to work the kinks out of all of this. And I'm going to tell you what some of the kinks was. First, one of the first kinks was getting the coat of arms. Now, coat of arms, they are described in something called heraldic French. And there are almost nobody who speaks heraldic French. And we had one woman who was an alcoholic who worked for Goodwill Industries in Akron, Ohio, named Josie.
Yep.
And she's the only one that we could find who could translate this ancient French language into a design that we could use to create a coat of arms.
Yep.
And that was a pretty inefficient and dysfunctional way to do it.
Yeah.
And here's a side story I think you'll like.
Yeah.
I was in the library of the University of Akron.
Yeah.
And I found a set of books, like an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Where they had almost a black and white drawing of every coat of arms ever recorded. You know,
we'd
start with Abraham, and then Brahmaham, and then Callahan, and then Zork, and then, you know, so they got down to Albert and Joyner, et cetera. And I mean, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And they were literature miniature. If you were a computer guy, now you'd call them thumbnails.
Right, right.
But they were exactly what we needed. And if I had those books, that means I didn't have to rely on Josie anymore.
Wow.
But those books were non-circulating. So I asked the person who worked at the library if on some condition I could take them out, you know, if I could leave a deposit or something, and I couldn't. And I said, "Well, could I speak to your boss or superior, whoever it was?" And I went up the ladder until I ended up talking to the guy who ran the entire show, telling him I wanted to take these books out. And he said no, and he said no over and over. And there was a guy with me who was our heraldic artist back at the time. And I walked out with those books after about 2.5 hours. And he said, "Gary, do you realize that guy said no to you 23 times?
Beautiful.
And he said, "Why did you keep talking?" And so I said, "I was going to keep talking if he said the right answer."
That's awesome.
So I walked out with these encyclopedias of coat of arms, and we took them to a drafting place. And they could take each page and enlarge it, and then we would have a coat of arms big enough to use. The original product was 8.5 by 11 piece of parchment-like paper that had a black and white drawing of your coat of arms.
Yep.
And a description of your family name and its history and its motto, and if it had one or something. But now we didn't have to rely on Josie anymore, and now we could really go into business.
Yeah.
Well, here's another really curious tale. Everybody used to keep their names in alpha order.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do big mailings, and the company, and they may still be true, I don't know, that had the biggest alphabetical list of names in the world was Donnelly out of Oak Brooks, Illinois.
Yeah.
And however, they no longer had their names in alpha order because zip codes had just been invented.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted their names in zip code order because if you would give your mail to the post office pre-sorted in zip code order, they'd give you a discount on
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So we now had the equivalent of all the telephone books in the United States in zip code order.
You cut your costs on this thing in so many ways.
Yeah, but wait, you don't get it. We couldn't use the list.
Oh.
Because it was in zip code order. The joiners weren't all joined.
I see.
Okay,
I see.
So, you know, it was either back to the phone book or work this out.
Ah.
Now, so what we had to do is we had to pay Donnelly to pass over their entire list.
Yeah.
And we're talking, you know, like 170 to, you know, almost 200 million names.
Yeah.
And there's something that many of the people listening to this don't know. But back then, computers didn't have what, I don't even know if they use the term now, but they didn't have random access.
Right.
You know, if you wanted to find joiner on a computer, you had to start with the A's till you got to the J.
Right.
And then
right.
because you couldn't type in joiner like you have now and get in.
Yeah.
So we had to have them pass that entire file and change it from zip code order to alpha order once again.
Right.
And it cost us $70,000 to do that, which in today's money is about $400,000.
Wow.
Okay, so they resorted the file for us in alpha order. Now we were in business. Because even back then, I didn't want labels on the envelopes, but Donnelly could give us what was called direct impression addressing.
Yes.
In other words, it would look like a typewriter had typed the address on that letter.
Yeah.
And letter shops have been able to do that for an awfully long time, but we told them that's what we wanted. Now, they were located in Oak Brook, Illinois.
Yeah.
So we would select names, you know, like we would take Miller, Abernathy, Joyner, Halbert, whatever.
Yeah.
And we would have them say, okay, give me all the joiners.
Yeah.
Give me envelopes with all the joiners
right.
on them. And we would have them sent from Oak Brook, Illinois to Bath, Ohio, so that we could give them to the Bath, Ohio post office to get the Bath, Ohio postmark.
Yeah.
Because I was that fanatical about wanting nothing to seem amiss about this being a personal letter.
Right.
Now, I can remember when we first started in business, you know, having to talk with the postmaster and saying, you know, you're going to have a hard time keeping up with our mail.
Yeah.
And but it took us a while to get going. And he would come over and he said, well, I was able to keep up with your three letters today, you know, or
yeah.
seven letters or something. And we had a little red house across the street that's significant that I'll tell you about this. That's the office that where we worked out of.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, we're having Donnelly ship in all of these names. Now, here's the thing. I got the letter written pretty quick, but I didn't really crack the code on it, and I have to give credit for my ex-wife Nancy cracking the code on it. we've mailed some names and we get almost no response. We'd mail other names and get like a 23% response.
What was up with that?
Well, that's a real good question.
Yeah.
I spent 18 months, and you talk about, you know, not being able to see a tree because of the forest.
Yeah.
Well, one day, I'm sitting there and I'm trying to figure out all these results that Vogel was right. And Nancy said, "It's really simple, you dummy." And I said, "What?" And she said, "People with the most common names are not going to respond, and people with the rarest names are going to respond higher."
Ah.
That was my second epiphany. You can't mail a coat of arms promotion and make a profit to somebody named Smith or Jones.
Yeah.
Because there are so many Smiths or Jones, they have a tendency not to believe you.
Wow.
They're not particularly interested in the fact that their name is Smith or Jones.
Yeah.
Okay. But now you get down to some, say, like my name, Halbert, is, or you get to Joiners. I don't think, I know about how many Halberts there are. I don't know how many Joiners
very
there are.
Very few.
Well, it's interesting that you say very few. Because everybody thinks there are fewer people that have their name than actually have it.
Yeah.
You know, there are about, I think at least back then, and there are more, there were about 1,500 people named Halbert.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is I had only met maybe fewer than 20 people named Halbert.
Yeah.
Because they were all my relatives. I never met anybody else named Halbert. Have
right.
you ever met another person named Joyner?
Outside of my family, only about one.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
However, when you get the names of everybody that lives in the state named Joyner, you're going to be surprised.
Yeah.
Not only are there, I think now there's around 3,000 people named Halbert.
Yeah.
And there's like 6 or 7 Gary Halberts.
Yep.
You know, so I would have never guessed that. I mean, what do you think the odds of are finding another person named Gary Halbert? Well, they're rare, but they're a lot higher than you would think because there's 5 or 6 or 7 of them. Okay.
That's right. When there's so many people that you're going to bump into throughout the day, I mean, yeah, the odds are pretty slim. Yeah.
So what we did then is we started mailing the. Then here's another thing. This is, I think, mind-boggling. Now, I not only needed to know, if you know certain names are common, Smith, Jones, Johnson, and so forth.
Yep.
But I needed to know exactly how common they were.
Yeah.
And I started to make a study of the names in all of the telephone books.
So, was there a correlation between the numbers, the frequency, and?
Well, let me get to that.
Yeah.
I was starting to do this with telephone books, and
yep.
believe me, this was a long, tedious job that was going to take what seemed to be like an eternity.
Yeah.
And then somebody told me that the Social Security Administration had alphabetized everybody's name in the entire United States and put them and arranged a report in rank order of their frequency.
Yeah.
Of how many names, how many people had that name.
Ah.
Now, since that was a government-generated product, you know, it was available to any United States citizen.
Yeah.
So I flew, I think it was Boston, where the Social Security Administration was, wherever it was, I went there. And I got that report, and that report was a piece of gold for me.
I bet.
And I asked them, I said, "This is going to be really helpful to me." And they said, "Oh, yeah, well, really, that's good." I said, why did you make this report? We said, "We don't know. But, you know, we just had a programmer that didn't have some time on his hands."
And, lucky for you.
And so he did this, and he gave this to me, and this was a piece of gold for me.
Did they say the percentages, by the way, or was it just ranked in order without any particular numbers?
Well, they didn't do the percentage of each name, but they ranked the names in order, not in alpha order, but by numerical order.
Yeah, yeah.
And just in case you're interested, at least at that time, there were approximately 1 million surnames in the United States.
Wow.
And if there were a population, I don't know what the population then was, but say it was 200 million, that meant that the average, if there would be such a thing, would, the average name would have 200 people on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, armed with this report, we started, we wanted to find the frequency of names that would be profitable for us to mail to.
Yeah.
And do you hear that noise, Mark?
Yes.
Do you know what that is?
I'm not sure what that is. We'll see if we can edit that out.
Okay. I'll just keep going. And so anyway, armed with this report, we started mailing. You know, we'd mail the real common names first, and then the less common, and then the less common, and the less common. And what we wanted to find is where we could start making a good profit.
Yep.
And where we could begin to make a profit is if a name had no more than 15,000 people, what we called the frequency, you know, and I don't know if that's a good word, but if there were 15,000 people in the United States, we could start to make a profit.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you, where the cutoff point was.
Yeah, but we could really start making a profit. The goal was if there were 7,500 people who had that name, 7,500 or fewer people who had that name.
Yes.
Okay, now... at the other end of the spectrum, if there were two
right
people with the name,
right,
we couldn't mail them either. Because remember,
cost too much.
We couldn't generate computer generated letters.
That's
like
right.
We can now.
Yep.
You know. And so we found the range that was what we I would call the sweet spot.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
People with this many names. And no more than this many, but no fewer than this many.
Right.
Because you're not going to type a letter and offset print it to people who have only 10 people who have that name. You may as well almost type all 10 of the letters.
Right.
And that's prohibitively expensive.
That's right.
So we found the name, and we found the frequency, and we started working that. And we started working that, and that business, once we had all of those things down, We had it down to, we were mailing so many names, and, you know, there were no credit cards back then, and I wish there were none now.
Yeah.
And we would get checks in, and we'd immediately recycle the checks into postage stamps and envelopes and so forth so that we could mail more letters.
Yes.
We had a little red house right across from the Bath Library. That was it was on Ira Road.
Yeah,
and that's where we started. Now the story's got a few more interesting things about it. Well, first we started mailing, and you know if you snowball your money in a mailing. Now remember our sweet spot. Although we knocked out all the Johnsons, Jones, Smiths, and other high caliber names and all the low caliber names, our sweet spot was still in the tens of millions of names. Maybe 70 million names were viable for us to mail.
Yeah.
And by the time we would finish mailing the 70 million, it was time to start mailing them again.
Right.
You know? Or 100 million. I don't know what it was. Okay. So we started out where the post office guy was laughing at us. Till we were mailing nearly, we got up to, at our peak, mailing nearly 1 million letters a week.
Wow.
Now, I had a brother-in-law, Sal, who was the mayor of a small town in Ohio, and he also had a big semi-truck.
Yeah.
And he would go to Donnelly and pick up the completed pieces of mail for us to mail.
Yeah.
And bring it back. Drive all the way back to Ohio. They were located in Oak Brook, Illinois, and bring
yeah
it back so we could get the Bath, Ohio postmark on it.
Right.
And he had to make two trips a week because the post office could only handle half the mail that we were mailing. in a week. I mean, you couldn't put more mail in that. We could only put, they only had room to store half the mail that we were mailing in any given week. So we had to make two trips a week to get the mail there.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. Well, the business started growing and growing and growing. And we were taking in 20,000 check with orders a day.
Yeah.
20,000 a day.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if there's a better way to do it now, but when we first started, we had like 40 women just doing nothing but making our bank deposits.
Yeah.
You know, depositing is a big job.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's something you couldn't do in a day. I don't know if you could do it in a week. You know?
Right.
So we had all these people doing that.
Yeah.
All right.
Long before the days of automatic processing of charges over the Internet.
So then we had to buy a tachometer, and I don't know if you know what a tachometer is.
No.
But a tachometer is something that counts things.
Yeah.
Like it counts theater tickets, it counts dollar bills, it counts checks or whatever.
Yeah.
And we would run our checks through the tachometer so that we'd know how many orders we had in a given day.
Wow. That reminds me of the stories of drug dealers who measured their money by weighing the money, right?
Exactly. Actually, we didn't think of that, or we might have, but we had to respond to everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we couldn't get away with weighing it, even if we had thought of it. But it does sort of remind me of that.
That caliber of largeness, right?
And now, here's a little side story to that.
Yeah.
We very quickly became the largest depositor in the First National Bank of that area. Very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, you're depositing 20,000 checks a day, you know. That's a lot of checks.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And
how many a day did you say again? One more time.
20,000.
20,000 a day.
We were grossing, in today's money, the equivalent of $250,000 a day.
Now, were these checks for, and I guess we'll get more into this when we talk about the letter, were they for I think you had a two-step process to this, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But we asked for money right with that letter.
Yeah.
I mean, so...
Well, I'm sure you'll get to that shortly. Yeah. Okay.
So we became the largest depositor of the bank.
Yeah.
All right? And then it wasn't very much longer after that that they devoted the entire third floor of the bank to us.
Yeah.
That was just us.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember that I was married then to Nancy, and we wanted to move out of our $70 apartment in Madison, Ohio to a really big deal house. $350 a month.
Yeah.
That's about what you pay for your place, I think.
And, I wish.
My mother and father, which, you know, were working class people, they begged us not to do something so insane as to move from a $70 to a $350 place.
You know. Well, you guys are risk takers, right?
And so before I tell you this story, I want to tell you another part of the story. First of all, giving us the entire third floor didn't last very long at all.
Yeah.
So they gave us our own bank. In the Norton Shopping Center, they had a building, and that was... They only did the Halberts Bank.
Kidding me.
I'm not kidding you. That's all. They couldn't handle it on the third floor. But while it was still...
That's insane.
While it's still on the third floor...
Yeah.
I've got to convince my father that it's okay. And I said, Dad, you know, you got a suit, don't you? And he said, yeah. And I said, listen, just get dressed up and just once, just go down to the bank with me. So we went down to the bank, and we go up to the third floor, and they say, hello, Mr. Halbert. And there's all these women sitting around taking checks out, making bank deposits, and they're bringing the money in in the checks, and some of it was money orders, some of it was cash,
yeah.
some of it was checks. They're wheeling it in on dollies in canvas bags, you know, like, you know, duffel bags of service.
Yep.
My father is looking at all of this, and, you know, he always knew his son would be nothing but, you know, white trash, you know, that.
Of course, right.
And he sat there, and I'm going to tell you, I think everybody listening has ever had a parent that they wanted to show something to will enjoy this.
Yeah.
My father didn't talk very much, but he said to the woman there, he said, "That's all from this company?" And she said, "Yeah." And he said, "My God, that's a lot of money to bring in for a week." And the woman looks at him and she says, No. She said, "That's just from today. That's just one day." And my son lost his ability to talk. He actually couldn't make sound, couldn't push wind over his vocal cords to talk.
Oh, my gosh.
He just couldn't even believe this.
That has got to be one of the greatest moments of vindication and pride.
Yeah. Well, listen to what happens.
Yeah.
So that afternoon, you know, I take him back home.
Yeah.
And my mother, whose name was Marbella, but we all called her Jo, Mama Jo.
Yes.
She asked my dad, she said, "Well, do you have anything to show you?" And he said, he couldn't talk till he had three double shots of whiskey.
Yeah.
Then he said, "Joe, you wouldn't believe what this boy has done. You would not believe what this boy has done."
Oh, that's great.
You know, and she said, "Oh, you know," she said, "it's all BS, you know." And he said, "No, it's true." He said, he couldn't convince her, and she didn't believe it.
You know, they say you can never be successful in your hometown. Yeah,
I think so. So anyway, I had a vacation scheduled for Florida.
Yeah.
You're going to love this. And I take a trip to Florida.
Yeah.
I go down to the Florida Keys, and I'm down there a week or two.
Yeah.
And I come back, and nothing's going to work except I've got to go take my mother to the bank.
Yeah.
So I get my mama all dressed up, and I take her down to the bank, and we go up to the third floor. And while I was in Florida, they had moved to the Norton Shopping Center to our building, and there's nothing but a bunch of empty tables and chairs.
So I imagine she was convinced at that moment that it was all a scam.
She knew that it was all garbage.
That's right.
It was, and I'm saying, "Mom, I'm telling you, it's true. And she says, "No, it was all garbage."
Oh, goodness.
So, but we finally got that straightened out.
Yeah.
My mama always loved me, whether I was rich or poor, but I think my father thought a little bit more about me after, you know. But anyway.
I would imagine. Goodness.
Anyway, so that is the progression of how that business works. Now,
yeah.
I want to discuss you, and you may have a few questions, a few things about the letter.
Yeah.
First, do you have any questions about the letter?
Well, I mean, so many. I mean, you've made literally hundreds of points, and I just wanted to tell people, you know, you got to listen to this conversation here several times. I would recommend, because I personally learned literally, you know, a couple hundred, you know, little fine points, and these little tiny refinements are what make a difference.
Now, let me tell you one of the biggest refinements.
Yes.
That people didn't notice back then. Do you have the letter in front of you?
Yes, I do.
What name is that letter mailed to?
It says, "Dear Mr. McDonald."
Okay, count the name, the number of McDonald's in that letter.
Yes, I remember. I see one, two. I imagine every time you do it, three. At least see three, just with a quick scan here. Four, I think.
Okay.
No, maybe five.
Four, maybe five. Okay, that's close enough. Now, here's the point. Once the advertising community found out that personalization tripled response,
well,
and by the way, when you triple response, you multiply net profit by about 800%.
Yeah.
Because the big bulk of the money goes to pay for your expenses.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So, now... So, but what did, that's the first thing I did.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you don't write a letter to say, "Dear Gary," and then mention my name 45 times in the mail and in the letter. And what they used to do, if personalization, you know, really increases response, let's just personalize the living hell out of the letter.
Right.
You know, and they say, "Dear Mr. Joyner, here's some exciting member news for you and all other members of the Joyner family.
We
have found something that the Joyners are going to be especially interested in. Because I'll tell you what, when you take the Joyner family down to X, you know what I mean? They put so much that first of all, they didn't even ever catch on that they should make the letter look personal anyway.
That's right.
So that's one of the biggest things, hidden persuaders in that letter.
Well, before
I didn't overdo it.
I was just going to say, before we get into that, I know that you're going to start talking about what actually mechanically made this letter work. And I did have a couple of questions about the history of it and the campaign. Before we get into that, so one was the issue of risk, and it's really fascinating what you did here. I mean, the one point that I honed in on earlier talked about the key discovery that allowed you to take advantage of a situation or take advantage of a certain piece of knowledge, and get an ROI from something that would have normally been extremely expensive. You went out and you realized you could just mail out to everyone in the phone book, but then I discovered, and this is the first time I had heard this part of the story, is the tremendous cost you put into actually sorting that. And I just wanted people to be able to benefit from your thinking in that, because I would just assume from looking at it that what you did is you probably did some small tests, did some math, and figured out, okay, I know it's going to cost me this much to sort this list, back into to last names, but I know that I'm going to get this much return. I mean, did you get that calculated with the math?
This is after we knew. This is after we had the Social Security report.
Right.
So we knew how many names we were going to be able to net out of this.
Okay, so you found your range, and then you sat there and you cranked it through a system. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, and I just wanted to zoom into that for everyone because, look, Gary didn't just capriciously say, "Let me, invest this much money." In that cost of sorting. So he knew beforehand that it was a very, very calculated and wise investment. So that was brilliant.
Yeah.
The next thing was I wanted to tune into a point a theoretical principle that I like to talk about a lot. And I noticed that this came up about 4 or 5 times in the discussion so far about the letter. And you read my last print book, Mind Control Marketing, I know.
It was one of the best books I ever read on marketing.
Wow.
Really, one of the best.
That, coming from you, that's huge. So thank you for saying that.
And I don't think much of you as a marketer. But I actually, to tell you the truth, I don't believe you wrote the book.
That's right. I probably didn't, and that's really the way
at least you know what to steal.
That's right. Well, one of the principles in the book is the principle of heavy ground, and there's a whole history of how I started applying military principles to my marketing, but one of them comes from Sun Tzu's Art of War, and Sun Tzu talks about 8 different types of ground upon which a battle can occur, and 2 that I want to zoom in on are deadly ground and heavy ground. Deadly ground is where you have 2 opposing forces that meet on a battlefield and there's no escape route. And obviously what's going to happen there is that combat must occur. And one of the things that the Art of War talks about is avoiding combat. You can win without actually, creating a conflict. Well, if you have a forced combat where you have 2 forces on the ground, the stronger force is going to win, right? Now, oppose that with heavy ground where you get deep into enemy territory and launch a surprise attack. Before the enemy can know what's happening. This is a force multiplier. A really crude metaphor would be, send a little 3-year-old girl, behind Arnold Schwarzenegger with a gun, and she's going to win that battle because he is surprised. He doesn't see that that's happening, right? Not even necessarily a gun. So the point of this is you have sort of like a little pseudo-combat with your consumer. And so who do you think is stronger, the marketer or the consumer?
Oh, the consumer, absolutely.
Clearly the consumer, right? So if you get into to deadly ground with a consumer, you are going to lose the battle. But if you get into heavy ground, you're going to win. And the whole point of this is you on so many levels, you went in and you got them to let down their defenses, to not think of this as marketing. This looked like a personal letter from the Smith-Jones thing. I mean, you found out that, hey, really common names weren't as believable as personalization. You made your letters look like real letters. And I would imagine that you went to great lengths to accomplish this.
Well, let's talk about persuaders.
Go for it. Hidden persuaders.
Do you notice that I said that we had the letters trucked from Oak Brook to get the Bath, Ohio postmark and on the envelope?
Interesting.
Because the return address said Nancy L. Halbert, you know, Ira Road, Bath, Ohio. And then the postmark said Bath, Ohio, too.
Wow.
And what I was thinking, if the postmark said Oak Brook, Illinois, you would think, wait a minute, you know, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
You know, when con men, when con men do a long con, they set up sometimes what they call a store. And that'll be a fake office where they'll bring the mark.
Yeah.
And they'll have people in there, you know, playing roles as secretaries and having meetings and stuff like that. And they'll have outside people calling into the office, you know, hey, George, you know, what's going on in the races today? You know, is it raining over there? Blah, blah, blah. But they'll arrange to have the phone ringing, you know, because when the mark walks out of that thing, if those phones weren't ringing, it might bring up some idea. He won't maybe consciously in his mind, but say something seems odd about that.
There's a cue that triggers, puts him into that deadly ground area.
Because when you're in a busy office, phones are supposed to be ringing.
Yes.
Now, you don't know that consciously necessarily, but on an unconscious level, you know phones are supposed to be ringing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they make sure that phones are ringing. And so that relates directly to me wanting them to have the Bath, Ohio postmark.
Right.
I didn't want anything.
Yes.
Raise the slightest question mark in their mind that this wasn't a personal letter from a woman named Nancy.
Beautiful. Okay. Beautiful. And did you actually test that? Did you see that other postmarks? Or did you just decide to do that intuitively?
Well, I decided to do that intuitively, but if I had to do it again, I'd also do it. For a reason, I don't want to get into a discussion about that. But but first of all, letter shops never mail all of your mail. And, but if they have to deliver it to you and you count it and mail it, that's another discussion.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. But that was the thing is that I didn't overuse it, and the other thing was. Is that I used the Bath, Ohio postmark.
Yeah.
And some of the other hidden persuaders was that the address wasn't labeled on there. It appeared to be tight.
Yeah.
Another hidden persuader was that it was the envelope had no teaser copy on this.
Yeah.
But nothing to suggest that it was anything but A-pile mail, which I define as anything that is or appears to be personal.
Beautiful.
People don't know how important this is.
Yeah.
How incredibly important all of this is.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's get into a couple of things. And I'm going to tell you something. This has more value now for people who use the Internet.
Yeah.
They won't know how from just listening to this conversation. But if they understood why this conversation applies to the Internet, they'd really give it. I'm going to give them one clue at the end of this.
Yeah.
First, I'm going to tell you another story.
Go for it.
Okay. And yet another hidden persuader. Back then, we sold, you got to remember that things were cheaper to do back then, and we could mail 1,000 letters for about a dime a piece. That was about $100 now.
Yep.
Okay? That's about 10 times less than it would cost you now. Even though it wasn't that long ago, you know, I mean, prices have gone up fast, haven't they?
Yeah.
Can you imagine a $350 luxury apartment now?
Oh, my goodness.
Or the luxury house.
Yeah, you know what I pay for my rent, my God. Wow, if I could have that, I'd be very happy.
and so anyway, the economics were that you could buy one for one of these sheets of paper for $2.
Yeah.
And that's what we were selling, sheets of paper.
Yeah.
But you could buy two for $3, only a dollar extra.
Yeah.
If they are ordered at the same time and we can send them to the same address.
Yeah.
You see the psychology there?
Yeah.
If we can, we'll send you another one at half price if we don't have to pay any extra postage to do it.
That's right.
In handling, et cetera.
Beautiful.
So our average order was for two.
Yes.
So it was $3. And so that was a hidden persuader that increased the gross revenue of what we were doing.
Now, how is that one a hidden persuader? You think that made it more believable as a personal letter?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're selling something for $2.
Yeah.
And I said, if you'd like to have another one, maybe, I forget what I said, but if you'd like to have another one, or you've got the letter there, read the actual copy. It's right at the bottom.
Right at the very bottom.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to scroll down to the bottom here, and everyone listening has got this PDF file. It says, P.S., if you were ordering only one report, send $2. Additional reports ordered at the same time and sent to the same address are $1 each. Please make checks payable to me.
Okay, you've got the part there. Additional reports ordered at the same time sent to the same address. Do you get that? Do you get that? So, in other words, if I'm going to send you a sheet of paper, and I didn't, of course, refer to it as a sheet of paper, a parchment-like paper, you know, and with your coat of arms and all that other stuff, but if we can send you two of these,
yes,
almost as cheaply as we can send you one.
That's right. That's right.
So
beautiful.
So we increased our profits dramatically by doing that. In other words, we increased our gross by 50%. And how much does that increase your net, for Christ's
sake? My goodness.
Okay. Now we're going to get to a really interesting part of the story.
I just want to say, especially, by the way, without increasing your costs at all.
At all. At all. Well, actually, it did increase our cost. That's not true. Because we had to have those coat of arms things printed up. And I think it cost us about a half a cent to print each one of us. So it cost us maybe half a cent or a penny to increase our gross by 50%.
Wow. That's a 200% ROI on that half cent, right? That's beautiful.
Okay. All right. Now we had this going, and we didn't even know that was the name of it then. But
yeah.
What we needed was a back end.
Yeah,
you know, we didn't even know that, but we ought to sell more of this stuff. And I met a guy that lived in Ohio that he manufactured ceramic stuff, and he manufactured plates and cups.
Yeah.
And all kinds of different things with people's coats of arms on. And he had a page in somebody's catalog, like Sears. I went out to visit him.
Yeah.
And I said, how come you only have one page there to do this? And he said, that's all I can manufacture. And he was selling millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Millions of dollars of silverware, plates, platters, saucers, cups, you know, and stuff like that with the coat of arms imprinted on them because people wanted a coat of arms plate to put on their wall.
Right.
And he just couldn't do it anymore. So I thought, well, we need a back end of ourselves. So I went out and literally got a pup tent, and I went to southern Ohio. I lived in northern Ohio, and I went to the woods there. And I camped out for a few days in a tent, and I created a full-color catalog with approximately 70 items in it that you could get your stationery on.
Yeah.
Or you could get your coat of arms on. You could get it on a plate. You could get it on a cup. You could get it on a saucer.
Wow.
You could get it on a wall plaque.
Yep.
You could get it on stationery. Whatever. And I, you know, really fancied it up. I showed them pictures of our three product testers, which were my little children at that time.
Yep.
And all of the stuff. And we came back and we mailed that out.
Yeah.
And we mailed it out, and it didn't make any money. It lost money.
Right.
So I analyzed the results of that,
yeah,
and I found out that they only were that the top three items accounted for the majority of all of the money that came in. The
yeah.
people weren't interested very much.
Yep.
Certainly not enough to make it profitable and all this other stuff.
Yep.
They wanted these top three things. So I stopped mailing that full color catalog. And I changed it to an 8.5 by 11 tri-folded product brochure
yeah.
that featured the three top products in it.
The cost was much less for that.
Much. Well, that's not the point, though.
Yeah.
The point is that I was offering now what they wanted to buy.
Yeah.
What they wanted to buy.
You know, I was just going to say, I found that when you give people too many options sometimes, it really can kill the deal because it just confuses them, you know. And that's why I don't understand why a lot of catalog marketers can even make it sometimes because there's so much. I mean, it's a whole different dynamic, but I can see if just from zooming in on three, that fact, well, especially the right three, must have had a huge impact.
Well, you must have been secretly reading my mind, as you'll learn when I tell you what I'm going to tell you next.
Go for it.
Okay.
Go for it.
Next thing I'm going to tell you is this. We didn't make any money on that brochure.
Really?
Nope. Didn't make any money on it. We just broke even on it.
But did you offer them one later?
No, I offered, well, remember, I offered three.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we went from a catalog of 70 that lost money to three to a brochure that broke even.
Broke even, okay.
Now I did the statistics and I found the top selling item.
Yes.
And it was a wall plaque.
Yep.
And it was a hand-painted wall plaque.
Yeah.
So I picked out a name.
Yeah.
And I say I picked out the Joiner coat of arms.
Yeah.
And I sent a letter with a photograph of the Joiner coat of arms.
Yeah.
In the letter. You know, I could get a roll of film developed and,
yep.
you know, and if there were 1,000 Joiners, I would have 1,000 photographs reproduced from one negative.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
But we would mail it out. And that, the returns from that were absolutely unbelievable. It's, you know, some,
wow.
The letter is something like, you should see what your coat of arms is going to look like in full color. And we tell them we're going to start advertising this in Good Housekeeping magazine. They're going to sell such and such. But since we've already done your coat of arms, and you know, we already have a sketch of it, and we have this, we could offer this to you to a substantial discount. And that was the most profitable letter we ever mailed.
Right.
Probably the most profitable letter I ever mailed in my history.
Can I ask you a question about
yeah.
that? Okay, so wow, that's just so fascinating because it illustrates so many interesting principles. But were you still sort of operating under the guise that this is a personal conversation, or had the veil of the business been lifted
nope,
by the time?
It was a personal conversation.
Okay, so it kept in the vein of the personal conversation. Now, the brochure in the catalog, that was all business, but this was still personal.
Well, you got a photograph.
That's right. It was an actual photograph.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. However, once you begin thinking this way, it gets addictive.
Yes.
And photographs are expensive to mail.
That's right.
So what I did, I was mailing fake computer letters at first. And, you know, by the way, for years, the advertising industry said, how is Halbert mailing all those computer letters? How can he afford to do that?
That's right. That's right.
I wasn't mailing computer letters, you know, because even back then, a computer letter would probably cost a dime or 15 cents.
Are you just mimeographing these off?
We were offset printing
them. Offset printing. And what is that exactly for the people who are just, you know, who only know dot matrix and laser printers?
well, if you go down to have 1,000 letters printed, I don't even know if they still use offset printing, but you just give it to them. They take a photograph of it, and then they print the negative or something, you know, and they... That's all. Offset printing is very common. I mean,
okay.
Put it in Google. What you can do it in your house. It's just a little cheap little printing press.
And it still looks like a real typewritten letter,
yeah,
though.
It looks like it's still real typewritten letter.
Now, so I imagine that you selected a font that looked like a typewriter. That was
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And,
beautiful.
And now that's that's a secret that would make a lot of the internet guys wealthy. I don't want to tell them about that. So now I've got these. This is a much more expensive mailing because, you know, now, you know, I don't know what photographs cost back then, but let's say they cost a dime. You know,
yeah,
that
yeah.
was a lot. You know, that was a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, what I thought is, hey, if we can make fake letters, a computer letter is a fake typewritten letter, and my printed letter was a fake computer letter.
Yeah.
So I got this idea. And what we do is we switched from offset printing
yeah.
to what's called gang printing.
Yeah.
And that's where they use a much bigger press. And they don't print one sheet of paper at a time. Just imagine the difference from a printer that'll print something from 8.5 to 11 to 11 by 14 or something
yeah.
to it'll print something as big as your living, the sheets of paper are as big as your living room wall.
Wow.
Okay? And they still do that today because they print them and then they cut them.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I did with the gang printers?
Huh.
I said, okay, and I'll just use Joiner, but as the name as an example, I would take. Let's say that we were getting into the names where we were mailing like 10,000.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'd go to a gang printer, and I would get the Joiner, take a picture, a photograph of the Joiner coat of arms.
Yeah.
All right, and then I would tell the druggist to give me 100 prints of it.
Yeah.
All right. Now
I see where you're going.
You got to visualize how this works out.
Yeah.
Is you take the big piece of paper that's the layout for the gang printer.
Yeah.
And you paste you paste 100 Joiner photographs on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you print 10,000 of them.
And you just cut them up. Right.
And cut them up, and it's on heavy stock, and it looks like a photograph.
And it still looks like a photograph at the end of the day.
It looks exactly like a photograph.
That
exactly.
is freaking beautiful.
Because I did it on heavy stock. And first, I did a white edge around the photograph.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on the back, you know, we would in triangular and blue, we would say something like Kodak or the drugstore printed in blue, just like they came back from the drugstore.
That's great.
So I took every precaution
yes.
I could conceivably make on both part of those promotions.
God, that's smart.
And to make them work. And after that, there was nothing else for me to do.
Yeah.
You know, I worked about a year and a half for that company, and unfortunately, not too long after that, I sold out and for what I thought was a lot of money back then. And But Dennis Haslinger, I remained friends with and did a promotion or two later on.
Yeah.
And, oh, I want to add an egotistical thing.
Sure. You earned it. Go for it.
We had a 50-50 partnership.
Yeah.
And he talked me into giving another guy that would help us administratively have a 2% partnership and said it's not good because 50-50 can mean that you can vote yes, I can vote no, the company can't progress.
And everything
well,
frozen,
I got squeezed out, you know.
Yeah.
Then he found out that writing copy, that he couldn't do it,
yeah.
and nobody in the company could do it. So he started going to New York to get advertising guys with Phi Beta Kappas and advertising agencies.
Because they're the best direct marketers in the world, right?
Yeah. And he hired 200 guys trying to replace me.
Yeah.
And then finally called me up and said, let's go on a ski vacation together.
Scary, old buddy.
That's how we got back together, and I immediately did another promotion that went gangbusters. I miss that guy. He's passed away now. But
oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But he was great. And but, you know, there are a lot of things that, I'm going to tell you something that I'm going to talk about the Internet now, if I may jump
Please.
A little bit.
Yep.
of the most powerful form of selling is face-to-face.
Yes.
The most likely way for me to achieve a sale from you is to take you out Sunday, have a dinner, you know, and then after the dinner and you're sitting there all satisfied, say, hey, Mark, let me tell you about a deal, you know. That's the most
yep.
powerful way.
Yep.
Second most powerful way is by sending a letter
yeah.
to somebody.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, that's wrong. By making a telephone call.
Telephone call. Yeah.
The third is making a letter.
Right.
And then they go down in ascending order.
Yeah.
And right at the tail end, behind matchbooks or restroom, the back of restroom doors, is the internet.
Yeah.
And and the internet is the least effective way of marketing in the world. It is the most efficient.
Yes.
And the less effective.
That's right.
Now
you got it.
I want to describe, even though I've done it before, the difference between effectiveness and efficiency, so that if you've heard this, Mark, a lot of these people listening will not have heard it, and it's a crucial principle.
Yeah.
I was born in Parkersburg, West Virginia,
yeah.
which is on the Ohio River.
Yeah.
It's about 30 miles south of Marietta, Ohio, which is on the north side of the Ohio River.
Yeah.
Parkersburg, West Virginia, is on the other side of the
yeah.
Ohio River.
Yeah.
Now, if you want, let's say that somebody wants to get to Marietta, Ohio.
Yeah.
And they want to get there in the most efficient way possible, and the only way they have to get there is by water.
Mm.
And they're on, and they don't have a motorboat, they only have a canoe.
Mm.
And they're paddling this canoe on the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how great canoers they are. They've got that J stroke down perfect.
It's 100% effective if they get there.
It's 100% efficient, Mark.
You
want to get this.
Okay.
They're traveling. Remember, they're on the Mississippi River.
I see.
On the Mississippi River. Maybe I didn't make that clear.
I see. So they're going downstream.
So they're going downstream
yes.
or upstream. It doesn't matter.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because Marietta, Ohio is thousands of miles from the Mississippi River.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter how efficient they can paddle that canoe.
Yeah.
You know, they've got the least energy expenditure for the most forward motion. It doesn't matter how efficient they are, because Marietta, Ohio is located on the Ohio River.
Yeah.
Okay.
I see. Okay.
Let's take the other end of the spectrum.
Yes.
And let's say that we are in Parkersburg on the Ohio River, and we want to get to Marietta, Ohio, and we don't even have a canoe.
Yes.
All we've got is an inner tube or a log,
yeah.
and we kick. And as long as we keep kicking north and we keep at it, we'll get to Marietta, Ohio.
Sometimes.
Because what we're doing, well, if we don't drive,
yeah.
we'll get there because what we're doing is effective.
Yeah.
And what the internet is very efficient. And that's what everybody has
yeah.
fallen in love with, is the efficiency of the internet.
Yeah, you can mail a million people easily.
Now, I'm going to tell you a story that is really true about a guy I worked with.
Yep.
Recently. And he was mailing, and I'm going to round this off to make it simple. He was making $30,000 a day
yep.
on the internet.
Yep.
And what he was doing was going after real estate leads. He was mailing 25 million emails a day.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now I'm going to get out my trusty big computer. That's 25000000.
Yep.
And he took in about 2,500 leads a day.
Okay.
Okay. And he sold them for enough money to make 30 grand a day doing that.
Yeah.
Now, there's no reason not to do that, you know, because it was really pretty cheap.
Right.
But let me tell you what he was getting back.
Yeah.
He was getting back. He was. You take one out of, let's see. What is one out of 10,000? 1% out of 10,000 is
going to be 0.0000001.
Well, yeah, but I'm trying to get the exact percentage. Let's say if 10,000, 10% is 1,000.
Yep.
1% is 100.
Yep.
1/10 of 1% is 10.
Yeah.
1/1,000th of 1% is 1. And
yeah,
that's what he was getting. 1/1,000th of 1%.
Yeah.
He was able to make it because of the internet efficiency.
Yeah.
However, yeah, he can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, they come knocking on your door if you spend 25 million emails.
He was sending out unsolicited email. It's 25 million.
You got it.
Yeah.
So he can't do it anymore.
Yep.
And so now he's back to marketing, attempting to marketing other things.
Yes.
With absolutely no success after a year whatsoever. Guess why?
He wasn't a good marketer.
He didn't learn his thing. Do you know, about paying the price to be a good marketer, you know, I couldn't figure out, when I was struggling to figure out what made some of these letters work and what didn't, one of the names I had was Miller, and I got a bunch of Miller coat of arms research reports. I took the map of Canton and Akron and Barberton, Ohio, and made a route of the Millers, and I went out and knocked on their door and gave them a report and talked to them about it. Because that was the thing I had to do. But what everybody, not everybody, but what most of the people on the internet are doing is they got a ride. They're like the dot-commers. The dot-commers have lost all those houses, all those jobs, all those everything, because they never learned the basics.
That's right.
There are a few things that come in vogue. I caught the infomercial vogue, where we could make 3 infomercials a day for like $600.
Yeah.
Get a, play them for $50 for a half hour.
Yeah.
You couldn't miss. That game's over now. It costs $250,000 to make it.
That's right. That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And 1 out of 14 works.
Yep.
You know, there was Fax Blast that you couldn't miss with. You can't do that.
Can't do it now. It's illegal. Yeah.
Windows of those things.
Yep.
And what I did early on in my direct mail career is I anticipated the time that it seemed ludicrous but I anticipated that one day maybe I would have to pay 50 cents a stamp.
Yeah.
It seemed insane at the time.
That's right.
It doesn't seem so insane now.
No.
Let me tell you what, email is going to start. People don't think email is going to remain free.
That's right.
It is not going to remain free.
You got it.
It's going to start at a penny, go to a nickel, go to a dime, whatever.
Yeah.
If that's going to happen, and if you don't have your marketing chops down, all this efficiency is not going to help you.
I couldn't agree more.
Okay. Now, I could tell you, I could sit and you know, I once, you'll recall this conversation, I once told you I thought I was the father of spam.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that.
And I don't, I've never spammed in my life.
We might want to edit this part out of the interview.
But what I did is in the early 1990s, when the internet was just starting to come into vogue, I got a bunch of internet experts in the room for a brainstorming session.
Yep.
Asked them a bunch of questions, and because they wanted to know how to make a profit with this.
Yep.
And I was saying, you ought to hear the tape of that. I don't know if I still got it.
I would love to hear it.
It's priceless. This is the absolute infancy of it. And I'm saying to the guys, now let me see if I've got this right.
Yeah.
You've got a file of 10 million names.
Yeah.
And you can mail messages to them for nothing.
That's right.
And you don't know how to make a buck out of that.
That's right.
Have I got that right?
Yep.
And the whole thing was that happened on the day of the big L.A. earthquake. It was Telly Savalas' birthday, and the earthquake happened that night. And they almost destroyed those tapes. But I just barely got those saved. Everybody should have those tapes, you know, because it's important to know the history of how things develop.
Yeah.
But I'm going to talk just very briefly about photography.
Okay.
Until relatively recently, when cameras were all automatic, the biggest question that when you took some pictures were, you always asked, did they come out?
Yeah.
That meant, were they too dark or were they too white or did they come out?
Right.
Did you see the picture?
Right, right.
And then along came all of the different automatic things.
Yeah.
Like auto exposure was the most important and a bunch of other interventions. That was by far the most important. And now all of your pictures come out.
Yeah.
But you know what? Hmm. The photographers before auto exposure are 100 times better than the photographers that never knew a camera without auto exposure.
Yeah.
You know, if I sat down and I had a room of internet marketers, now
yeah.
I'm going to ask you to reply. Mark, how well have I mastered computers?
You want an honest answer on that, right?
Honest.
Well, you know, they said that Einstein didn't know how to tie his shoes, so I can't fault you for this. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's foreign to you.
It is. I don't know how to upload something.
Yeah.
I don't know how to send instant messages.
Yeah.
When I learned the computer, I was interested in the stock market, and the guy who taught me said I was the fastest learner he had ever come across.
Yeah.
Well, he'd obviously never worked with a teenage kid. But I refused to learn anything that I didn't need to know. I learned how to get an intraday graph and how to look up a stock quote, news stories, and stuff like that. But I never learned anything else. Basically, I can open and read email, I can send email, and I can do basic research going to it. I do not know how to send an instant message. I do not know how to create a file folder. But I guarantee you, if you brought a group of your people in a room with me in a seminar or any place,
yeah,
and you just let them ask me questions and let me ask you questions, they would walk out of there knowing how to make more money from the internet.
Yeah.
Present company excluded, although I don't really mean that, than any other guru in the world could teach them.
That's right.
And I'm going to make a stab at proving that, if that's all right, just right now.
Please.
Because this is where everybody missed. This is the boat. And first of all, I want to tell you about, and I have told you about, but I want to tell your listeners about my internet hero.
Yeah.
He's a guy I have coffee with in the morning. He's 73 years old. He used to own a very famous restaurant called the Chesapeake in Isla Mirada in the Florida Keys.
Yep.
Now he lives in the Grand Hotel, which is very near to me. And in the lobby of the Grand Hotel, he has a little shop that sells hammocks.
Yep.
And a few other related items, but mostly they're hammocks, that he gets from Nicaragua.
Yeah.
And people walk by, look in his store, come in and buy hammocks. But 90% of his business comes from the internet.
Yeah.
I want to know how many people listening to this message could take hammocks and make a good profit from the internet on it. And I'll bet you it's almost none.
Yeah.
Because they're basically selling, you know, different things that are of sort of the same genre.
Yeah.
More effective ways to make money using the internet by teaching more effective ways. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's so much beyond that where you can go.
Yeah.
And to prove I can do this, to prove I could do this, and I'm starting to sound like a sales pitch. I don't have anything to sell here. That's my problem. But I'm going to prove to you that I could do that by telling your listeners that there are about 10 things internet marketers could do that just exponentially increases their response. You don't have to settle for 1/1000th% of a return,
yep,
even if it makes you a profit.
Yep.
Okay. Here's what you do. You say, In your sales pitch, I'm not going to go into all the ways the sales pitches should be and all the ways that websites are almost completely screwed up everything. I mean, almost everything internet marketers do is wrong. Almost every single thing they do is wrong.
Yeah.
But it's so cheap and so efficient that, you know, if a billion zillion monkeys paddle the canoe up the Mississippi River for a billion years until there was a climatological change and the Mississippi suddenly diverted and went to Marietta, Ohio to get there. That's why internet research can make it.
That's right.
All
that's
right?
Right. You're right.
That, you know, you said yourself the internet proved that wrong about a billion monkeys and a billion typewriters.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because we've had the equivalent of that happening,
yeah.
And clearly the works of Shakespeare haven't surfaced on the internet. So.
Now, I'm going to tell you just one internet secret. Just one. And there's something I want you to know. I don't know anything about websites. And I have, I'll bet you, almost one of the most profitable websites on the internet.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how to do it.
Right.
But I don't know how to put one of my newsletters off.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to do anything. But let me tell you this. My newsletter contains the name of my company.
Yeah.
It contains my telephone number.
Yep.
It contains my fax number, and it contains my address.
Yeah.
And furthermore, what you really should do in your letters, and this was developed after the Code of Arms, I've learned, if you're ever in Massillon, Ohio, please stop in and locate us. Our store is located at 123 Elm Street.
Yeah.
That's right across from the public library and about a half a block from the police station.
Yep.
We're open from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Mm.
And our telephone number is 216-861-9053.
Yeah.
Okay, now here's why that is so absolutely critical.
Yeah.
The number one reason people don't buy from you is they don't want what you're selling. Hard to overcome. You know, they don't want what you're selling.
Yeah, and you're fighting a losing battle if you try to convince
them. And
the
number two reason they don't buy from you is they can't afford what you're selling.
Yep.
The number three reason they don't buy from you is they don't believe you or they don't trust you.
Yeah.
And on the internet, they have very valid reasons for not trusting you.
Yeah.
You're not a person. You're not anywhere. Most of them, anyway.
Yeah.
You're something is floating in the ether somewhere. And people want to know that they can reach out and get you.
Yeah.
Think of that song. I'm going to get you.
Yeah.
They want to know they can call you. They
right.
want to know they can come. They're not going to do it. Stop worrying about that. You know, you can put an answering machine on the phone and say, "Hi, this is ABC Widget Company. We're busy right now, but if you'll leave your name and number and the purpose of your call, we'll call you back."
Yeah.
But they know they can call you.
That's
and
right.
they're never going to go to Massillon, Ohio. But listen, we had that little red house across from the post office.
Mm.
Do you know that a lot of snowbirds traveling north to Florida went through Bath, Ohio, so they could go see Nancy Halbert in that little red house off of the post office, and we had elderly women working in there. They said, "Oh, Nancy's not here right now. She's visiting her relatives." But they would talk to them. So everything to make it more legitimate.
That's amazing.
And
you really did that.
Huh?
You really did that.
I really did that.
Wow.
Did everything. Now, just in case the people listening to this think that all of this is something of a big deal.
Yeah.
You should know that was the biggest heraldic company in the world.
Yeah.
I have no idea how many hundreds of millions of dollars it grossed.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, after I sold it, and after Dennis Haslinger died, you know, the lifeblood went out of it, and the family trust inherited it, and Ancestry.com bought it 30 years later. It's still going 30 years later. They bought it for $75 million.
That's amazing.
We had companies located. We had operations in 8 countries, any place they spoke English. You know, our market was people that spoke English and had a name.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're in Australia, England, every place. But what I've been trying to get you is not even exactly thinking outside the box. This is almost still inside the box thinking for me.
Yeah.
But the internet marketers, it's a shame. It's a shame that they never went through this, because their marketing would be so much more profitable. It would be absolutely unbelievable.
I couldn't agree more.
They're making money doing everything wrong because they can do it nearly free.
Yeah, I
just want to say this. I want you to imagine something.
Yeah.
Imagine you put together a sales catalog, a sales brochure, and it's really crappy. It's horrible.
Yep.
But for some reason, maybe because Bush is president, he gives you, and he thinks you're related to Cheney.
Right.
A lot of people hate that. He's agreed that the U.S. government is going to print 100 million of these crappy catalogs of yours, or crappy brochures, and take them up in Huey helicopters,
yep,
and just let them free fall over the biggest populated areas in the United States.
Right.
You know what? You're going to make a profit.
That's right.
And that's why, that's how internet guys make a profit.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Well, and that's the thing.
I also lecture on sex and politics when I'm done.
That's right. I think we can all use lessons in all these topics. It's, I just have to say, I think you're so right about that. It is the efficiency of the internet that has allowed these guys to make money, and unfortunately, it's changing for a lot of people, and they're not finding it as easy as it used to be.
It's going to get exponentially harder.
That's right.
And the thing is, you know, here's the thing. Remember that German group where they found out that they were lip-syncing all their music? What was their name?
Milli Vanilli.
Milli Vanilli?
Yeah.
You know what? If you're an internet marketer and you're listening to me, you should think of yourself as Milli Vanilli. And that all of a sudden the rules are going to change and you have to play for real.
Yep.
You know, that you can't lip sync and do it anymore. There's no CD in the background or no sound system that's going to back you up. You've got to learn to sing and play. And if you don't, guess what? You're going to be the buggy whip.
You know, this is why I tell people when I try to teach people about marketing, I always try to break it down to some kind of core underlying principle. I say, look, I can teach you tactics all day long, and those may serve you for the short term, but if you don't understand the underlying principles, you're not going to be able to reproduce that yourself, and you're not going to be someone who performs in the long term. And if they can understand, you know, how the brain works, why people make buying decisions, no matter what, they can adapt themselves to whatever that changing environment is and still make money. So because of that, I think that approach is absolutely critical to success.
Well, with the efficiency of the internet, if you would combine that with effectiveness, you have a printing machine akin to the U.S. Mint.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I think that the people, that there are people who are doing it more effectively than most, but still
every
not
day, every day.
Every day. The thing is, you know, there aren't enough out there, and people don't understand the dynamic. You know, they think that, well, all I've got to do is send out an email. They don't stop to think, what is the state of mind someone is in when they're receiving that email? You know, are they receiving it as spam? What is their opinion of you? What is their opinion of the letter? How are they feeling? And if they take that into consideration, they can craft their offers. We used to send out really, really personalized emails. One was really interesting. There was a seminar we did in Los Angeles called Survival Tactics for Tough Times. We had some great, great guests out there. And I sent out these personalized emails to people saying, hey, I want to send you a personal invitation to come out, you know, for free. And literally about 15 people came up to me in the seminar and said, hey, Mark, I got your invitation. Thank you so much for bringing me out here for free. And I didn't have the heart to tell him, you know, well, you know, that's pretty much everyone in the room. But that got, you know, 800 people from all over the world in a room. Okay, if I had not personalized that approach like that, okay. Now, some people said, hey, don't you think that was a little bit, you know, dishonest, you know, sending out, you know, an email, like a personal invitation? And I would say, look, okay, it's a little bit tricky, but, I mean, the fact is, you know, we gave them the value of a $5,000 seminar for free. And I told the presenters, I said, look, this isn't a pitch fest. This is a real seminar. You're going to make backroom money, but that only happens when you make value. And I think at the end of the day, you know, you can get a little tricky like this.
Well, let me tell you between the difference between a con man and a salesman.
Yeah.
They both use exactly the same technique.
Right.
The difference is the salesman delivers something of value.
Yes.
The con man just takes the money.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In the new print book I have coming out, one of the things I said was, people tell you sell the sizzle, not the steak. And I say, well, selling sizzle without steak is a con. You know, it really is. See, I think you've totally honed into the difference. It's all about delivering value. And I think that's a great lesson for people. You know, if you want to make long-term success in your business, you do have to deliver that value. Because people will remember that you did deliver or over-delivered, and they'll want to come back to you for more.
You are correct.
Gary, thank you so much for this today. I think there are 1,000 micro lessons that were given in this conversation, and I would just urge everyone to listen to this many, many times over. You've got a great resource here. So, Gary, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. Okay.